Coming up is the news.
Palestinian factions say that rising violence by Israeli settlers and soldiers in the occupied West Bank needs to be stopped. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, an icon in South Africa's fight against apartheid, dies at age 90. A Chinese city of 13 million people in lockdown for a fourth day over a surge in COVID cases. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Badr Zajafik. Good to have you with us. Now, starting with top story this hour, Palestinian Authority urging the international community to intervene to protect the Palestinians in the face of increasing settler violence that has left hundreds injured in the West Bank in recent days. The authority saying that the Israeli regime must be held to account for a surge in what are called terrorist attacks by settlers against defenseless Palestinians. Meantime, Palestinian factions are calling for the formation of local protection committees across the West Bank. Last night, Israeli settlers and troops attacked the village of Burqa, injuring nearly 250 people. Soldiers targeted them with live bullets, rubber-coated rounds, stun grenades, and tear gas. The village has been a flashpoint of clashes in recent days. It sits near the site of a former settlement. The Israeli military destroyed that settlement in 2005, but now the settlers are saying that they want to return. Saudi warplanes conduct fresh airstrikes on Yemen, this time targeting the country's capital, Sana'a. According to local media, at least three airstrikes were carried out against the residential area. They left a number of houses damaged, but no casualties have been reported. Now, this after the Yemeni army said it struck vital and sensitive Saudi sites in retaliation for the kingdom's escalating aggression against its southern neighbor. Army spokesman Yahya Saria says the positions in the port city of Jazan were targeted with three state-of-the-art precision-guided missiles. He warned of, quote, more painful operations as long as Saudi Arabia continues its atrocities against Yemen. Riyadh and its allies launched a ruinous war in Yemen in March 2015, killing hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, and causing a dire humanitarian situation. Now, our correspondent Sana'a, Abdullatif Al-Washali, has been following the developments in Yemen, and here's an update on the situation there.
The Saudi planes again targeted another residential early area called the Libyan neighborhood. A number of houses were destroyed by the airstrikes, and the military experts say that the Saudi-led coalition is using a specific type of bombs that causes fires. Whatever it's a drop, the fires are there, and the firefighters are on the way to the place that was targeted. The Saudi warplanes or the Saudi coalition has also threatened to target the Az-Zubayri Street in the capital Sana'a, which is a very crowded area. I live there, and they said that they will target this area again today, and they know that it is very crowded and residential area, so they don't have the right to bomb such a place, such area, which is a residential area. I took my family to a farther place, to a few miles away from the airstrikes. They are targeting civilians. They are killing Yemeni people. And unfortunately, the international community remain silent toward the Saudi crimes that are being committed on daily basis.
The next hashtag trending takes a look at social media reactions to the latest Saudi coalition air raids that have targeted residential areas across the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, Ali Reza. Today, we'll take a look at social media's reactions to the latest coalition airstrikes that targeted residential areas across Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The Saudi-led war on Yemen will soon turn seven. 7 years of unabated killings and destruction. Just this past Friday, as you might have heard on the news, the Saudi bombers targeted several locations across the capital city of Sana'a, including a sports complex which hosted the country's national soccer team matches. The Saudis had alleged that the Ansarullah resistance movement was using the Al-Thawra sports complex as an arms depot. But that was an unfounded claim, according to Yemeni officials. They have now called on the United Nations for a thorough investigation of the incident. Let's get on with our comments reel, with our first tweet coming from Nasruddin Omer, the Deputy Minister of Information of Yemen's National Salvation Government. He said this: "We call on all the media operating in Yemen to visit Al-Thawra Sports City in Sana'a to verify that it is free of any weapons, as the coalition of aggression claims, and we are ready to bring them to the stadium." Our next comment comes from Muhammad Abdus Salam. He wrote this: "Scenes from the effects and damages of the air raids of the aggression on Al-Zubayri Street in Sana'a." Our next tweet comes from Afshin Ratanzi. He said, "Reported photos from Wednesday night's UK-US-EU multi-billion dollar warplane weaponry attacking Al-Sabain Maternity and Childhood Hospital in Yemen's capital of Sana'a, in what the UN calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis." True, Yemen remains the world's worst humanitarian crisis, with over 20 million people in dire need of humanitarian assistance. At least one child dies every 10 minutes because of preventable diseases, and in some parts of the country, one out of every four children is now acutely malnourished. Moving on to our next comment by Shaista, it reads, "Kill them before they are born policy, probably. Shame on the Muslim-loathing rogue regimes of UAE/Saudi. Moving on to the next comment by Jay, it reads, "Attempting to eliminate the Arabs and use other Arabic nations to punish the poorest Arabs while the suffering is inhuman, the Arab people are divided again like in 1918 by the Western friends/arsenal of democracy." Over here, Randolph Pitts wrote, "And what are the U.S. headlines? Manchin, Biden, and the ludicrously misnamed Build Back Better bill. The U.S. and the EU's and their associated arms merchants' support of this war should be what the news is focusing on, not squabbles over nothing by unprincipled politicians." Or maybe even this piece of news that got lost during the Christmas hype, that the World Food Program is reducing its food assistance to the starving Yemenis. 400,000 Yemeni children are expected to suffer from life-threatening severe malnutrition in the coming months as a result. Moving on to our final batch of comments, Rhonda wrote this: "Christmas in is Yemen, paid for by America's working class due to the corruption and treasonous policies of the United States Congress. Hashtag Yemen." Mahmoud Refat wrote this on Twitter: "Children of Ethiopia and Yemen face same death by famine and bombs, and behind this same perpetrator, money and arms of the UAE and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia exported terrorism for decades to the whole world, and today the UAE exports genocide." Our final comment for today comes from Chief Sharp Noise. He wrote, "Yemeni babies left without food by Saudi, US, UK, Emirati coalition. Can you imagine their parents? This war crime should be over." Well, that's going to do it for this edition of Hashtag Trending. Let's head back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
Well, that was Ali Reza with Hashtag Trending and social media reactions. Now, moving on, South Africa's anti-apartheid icon Desmond Tutu dies at the age of 90 after decades of fight against injustice. Tutu was receiving treatment for prostate cancer at a hospital in Cape Town, President Cyril Ramaphosa saying that his death marks another farewell to a generation that has struggled for the liberation of South Africa. Tutu was the country's first black Anglican archbishop. He won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 for his campaign against the country's previous brutal system. A decade later, he witnessed the downfall of that regime, but he never stopped his fight even after the apartheid's end. South Africans nicknamed him the moral compass of the nation. Now to another African country. In Sudan, security forces clashing with protesters demonstrating against the October military coup d'etat. Riot police used tear gas and water cannons to disperse the rallyers, and that after thousands of demonstrators converged on the presidential palace in the capital to express their anger and demand a civilian rule. A number of protesters were wounded. A similar event was held in Madani, a town south of Khartoum. Authorities cut the internet and telephone lines. The African country has witnessed protests since the military takeover on October 25th and the arrest of civilian leaders. The rallies are staged despite the reinstatement of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok, who was ousted in the coup. A sad night for Congo. A suicide bombing has killed five people in the city of Beni. The bomb went off at a crowded restaurant as people were celebrating Christmas. 13 others were injured. Local officials say that the attacker activated a bomb at the entrance of the venue after security personnel stopped him. They were blaming the militia group Allied Democratic Forces. The ADF is one of the deadliest armed groups in the troubled region and is aligned with Daesh terrorists. It's accused of killing thousands of civilians over the past decade. Congo and neighboring Uganda recently launched a joint operation to try to quell the ADF's bloody attacks. Authorities in the Indian-controlled Kashmir have reopened a 125-year-old church that was closed in the 1980s. The Muslim-majority Himalaya region saw the opening of the church on Christmas Eve as a gift to Kashmir's tiny Christian community. A correspondent has a report.
There were heartwarming scenes in Kashmir's main city of Srinagar as St. Luke's Church reverberated with traditional bells and religious prayers for the first time in three decades. 125-year-old heritage church was given a facelift and thrown open for the public on Christmas Eve. The church is situated at Srinagar's Dalgate area, about half a kilometer distance from the world-famous Dal Lake. For the region's small Christian community, the church's reopening is a dream turning into reality. The Muslim neighborhood also felt joyous after the church was made functional and distributed kahwa, a hot beverage prepared with multiple spices, including saffron. Official estimates say Kashmir Valley has less than 1,000 Christian citizens. The Muslim-majority region has always maintained harmonious relations with the minority community. This year, the church has finally reopened after a gap of three decades. The Christian community says there can be no better gift than this from the Muslim community on this Christmas. Shahana Butt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Surge in China is pushing daily COVID infection to a new high in 21 months. The northwestern city of Xi'an is the new hottest spot, reporting most of the cases. The city is now in its fourth day of lockdown with 155 domestically transmitted cases. That's more than double from 2 days ago. The national daily count now standing at 158. That's the highest since China curtailed a nationwide outbreak in early 2020. So far, no infections caused by the Omicron variant detected in Xi'an. Authorities have conducted several rounds of mass testing in the city of 13 million. Despite a flare-up, the overall death toll remains flat. The Christmas travel chaos continues across the world. Hundreds more flights facing cancellations and delays due to the surge in the new COVID variant Omicron. According to the flight tracking website, on Sunday alone, some 1,100 flights were scrapped worldwide. There were thousands of delays as well. That's the third day that a staff shortage caused by a rise in COVID cases has placed airlines in a dilemma. Overall, more than 6,000 flights have been canceled over the long Christmas weekend. The Chinese airlines are the most affected, with China Eastern scrapping more than 1,000 flights in just 2 days. American airlines are also hit hard by the crisis. On Saturday alone, almost 1,000 flights originating from or headed to U.S. airports were canceled. Now, while Christians around the world are celebrating Christmas, the festive occasion is also observed here in Iran that hosts a small minority of Christian population. Yusuf Chalali went to a Christian neighborhood in downtown Tehran and filed a report.
It's the Christmas season, and the happy mood can be felt everywhere, including here in Muslim-majority Iran. Every year on Christmas, this street in downtown Tehran gets packed with Christian residents who rush to buy last-minute items to celebrate the birth of Jesus. And oh yes, Santa is also here.
Merry Christmas to all of you. I'm so happy to celebrate our Christian festivity in Iran. We Armenians celebrate Iran's Nowruz and Iranians take part in our joy. It's so valuable.
I congratulate all Christians in Iran and the world on Christmas. Every year we come here to buy the Christmas tree and other items to celebrate the festivity.
While 2020 was a year of complete exhaustion, 2021 ushered in hope for a return to pre-COVID normal. Now, as the coronavirus pandemic is marching into its third year with the Omicron variant, many people remain ambivalent about whether to stay home or throw parties.
I wish that the coronavirus will go away in the new year. I urge everyone to stay home this year and celebrate Christmas with family members to stay safe.
The new variant of the coronavirus disappointed us. We thought we would be able to gather together and once again have a crowded celebration. I hope that next year the pandemic will be over.
Nearly 120,000 Christians live in Iran. The majority of them are Armenians who follow the Oriental Orthodox branch of Christianity. While they make up less than 1% of the Iranian population, they feel at home when it comes to Christmas.
Last year, Christmas was celebrated with social distancing and a prayer that the coronavirus would be a thing of the past, a wish that has partly come true thanks to science. Now, as Omicron is our new unwelcome Christmas guest, let's keep on our safety distances and ring in 2022 with all the good vibes until the virus is totally gone. Merry Christmas to you all. I'm Yusuf Jalali in Tehran.
All right, now moving on to a really exciting high-tech event. The world's most powerful observatory is finally on its million-kilometer journey after several technical delays. The NASA telescope, named James Webb, blasted off into orbit on Saturday, heading for an outpost that's 1.5 million kilometers away from us. The observatory was in the making for some 3 decades and cost about $10 billion. It left Earth enclosed in a rocket and from a launch pad in French Guiana in South America. The journey will last a month. The telescope is the size of a tennis court, and if everything goes according to plan, it'll enter service in June. Astronomers hoping that they can learn more about the origins of the universe once it starts beaming back new clues. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shmanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of first grade. My dad, who taught me the art of
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warm greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special on this beautiful Sunday, December 26, 2021. I'm Atef Erfani, hosting this program today. As you may know, Listeners Special is a Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, and messages from around the world. So, contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. If you have any message for our listeners around the world, then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard. Do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. And on behalf of IRIB English Radio staff, we congratulate you. And, of course, our Christian listeners on the birth anniversary of Prophet Jesus, the Messiah, peace upon him, and on the occasion of Christmas. Merry Christmas to our Christian listeners. We wish all people around the world, especially our listeners around the world, peace, love, joy, health, and good tidings on this Christmas and the New Year 2022. Keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, the Sunday program of course, your program. And as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us in IRIB English Radio, especially to our technicians and engineers. You know why? Because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service our listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card, an electronic QSL card, of course, in the time of pandemic. So here, I sent my appreciations to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Konstantin Barsenko from Russia, Bruce Lee from Australia, and Bill McDavid from the U.S. And, of course, we have received many emails and letters from around the world, which I mentioned some of their names here, and later during the program I will read their emails or letters. Most of these emails and letters are focused on the Christmas and the New Year 2022. First of all, thank you for sending us these emails, and let me read the names of those of our listeners who have sent us these emails. First of all, we have an email from Igor Belevich from Belarus, who has recently joined us. Konstantin Barsenko from Russia has sent us an email. Toshio Shibata, one of our old and regular listeners from Japan, has sent us an email. From India, we have an email from P.S. Sukar. And the last but not the least is an email from Australia from Martin Sainer, one of our old and regular listeners. So, stay with us, please. After a short break, I will be back with these kind emails. Welcome back. Before this program was started, I was just checking these emails, and I found that most of them are focused on Christmas, congratulation messages, and sharing the experiences in Christmas, and those experiences were so sweet, and it made my day. As I said, we have received an email from Belarus from Igor Belevich. Let's see what he says. I live in a city called Ivatsevichy, Belarus. Yes, Ivatsevichy. I remember my childhood and how I would celebrate New Year and Christmas together with my parents and my younger sister when I was a schoolboy. That is 1992-21. In our four-room apartment in Ivatsevichy. Also, 2006 Christmas was a very good year because an Australian SW radio station sent me a radio receiver as a gift and made my day. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Igor Belevich from Belarus, in this cold day, of course, for Northern Hemisphere residents. Thank you very much for sending us this email. Yes, you live in Ivatsevichi, Belarus. And your childhood memories was great. Thank you for sharing your experiences for the Christmas. And it was great. Yes, always everyone's childhood memories are the greater and best part of people's memories. And so it was great as you described it. So you were gifted a radio receiver from an Australian SW radio station as a gift. Yes, it was great. Let me tell you one thing. IRB English Radio used to send its Christian listeners gifts, so many gifts, postcards, the souvenirs. But in the time of pandemic, unfortunately, we can't do that. Of course, after this disease is controlled around the world, then we will send all our dear listeners, especially our Christian friends who didn't receive the souvenirs of IRB English Radio in the time of pandemic, many gifts. And of course, those beautiful postcards of Iranian monuments to all our listeners around the world. But at the time, we will send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. Igor Belevich, many thanks for sending us this email. Merry Christmas to you. We wish you all the best in the new year 2022. And from Russia, we have an email from Konstantin Barsenkov. Konstantin says, dear friends, from the bottom of my heart, I wish you, your loved ones, and all your friends a happy new year, health, peace, and success in 2022. I would be very appreciated for any confirmation, including an EQSL card of my report, and thanks in advance. First of all, salam and warm greetings to you, Konstantin Barsenko from Russia, and I do express my appreciations to you for sending us, and of course, our dear listeners around the world, this congratulatory message on Christmas and 2022. Of course, in Iran, we Iranians celebrate our new year at the beginning of spring. We call it Nowruz, and we have broadcast many programs on that. Anyway, we accept your congratulation message, and we wish you all the best in life. We wish you peace, love, joy, good tidings in 2022, and a very happy new year and very happy Christmas. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card. Konstantin Barsenko from Russia, thank you very much for sending us this email. After a short break, I will be back with an email from Japan, from Toshio Shibata, one of our regular listeners. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and I'm here with another email, with another congratulatory message and Christmas experience from this time, from Toshio Shibata from Japan, who says, in Japan, except for Christians who account for less than 1% of the population, we do not regard Christmas as a religious event. Even in families of Buddhist temples, they have Christmas parties for children. For Japanese children, Christmas is not one night, meaning December 24th. And it is a family event. We may have a small Christmas tree in the room, have a special dinner with chicken, not turkey, and a Christmas cake. The next morning, children find presents from their parents. It is a common question to grown-ups, until what age you believed in Santa Claus? We had much more fun in New Year holidays, as my mother had 5 brothers and sisters. I had about 10 cousins of similar ages. Once a year, we got together in grandparents' home and spent holidays train and flight reservations for New Year 2022 are much more crowded. I hope we will be able to be back to normal life soon. I wish you the same. Salam and warmest greetings to you, Toshio Shibata, one of our old and regular listeners from Japan. I send you my gratitudes for sending us this email, and of course, thank you for sharing your Christmas experiences to us in IRB English Radio and our great listeners around the world. So, in Japan, you celebrate Christmas, and it's not just for Christians, it's for all the Japanese. Okay, it was great what you said. You have a special dinner with chicken, and you have a Christmas cake, you have Christmas tree, and that's great. So we wish you all the best in the new year 2022 and Christmas time. And thank you very much for telling us these informations about your Christmas experiences. We wish you all the best. We wish you health, peace, joy, love, and good tidings. Write to us soon, Toshio Shibata. And don't forget to tell us your views about IRB English Radio broadcast. And from India, we have a message, a congratulatory message, from P.S. Sakar. Yes, P.S. Sakar from India has sent us a message. He says, "Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, I wish all the listeners across the world for New Year to 2022. I hope the New Year will bring everyone health, prosperity, and hope for a better world. Kindly arrange to issue a QSL card. Thank you. Salam and warm greetings to you, P.S. Sakar from India. Thank you very much for sending us this message, this congratulatory message. We also wish you health, prosperity, and hope in the new year 2022. My colleagues soon will send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. So after a short break, I will be back with an email from Australia from Martin Schneider. Stay with us, please. Welcome back. Martin Steiner from Australia has sent us an email. He says, "Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, I would like to express my best wishes to you and the whole team of IRIB English Radio. My childhood memories of Christmas are playing in the snow without ever feeling cold, as we had so much energy as kids. Nowadays, I live in Australia and Christmas is now in the summertime. It just does not feel right. Nevertheless, we have a great time meeting all the family for a nice dinner with lots of laughter. Following the Christmas celebrations, we spend time on our beautiful beaches, go for a swim, or do fishing. Best wishes to you all." Salam and warm greetings to you, Martin Steiner from Australia. Yes, it's the environment and the atmosphere of Christmas in the Northern Hemisphere is so much different with the atmosphere of Christmas in the Southern Hemisphere. So Australians are celebrating Christmas and the New Year in the sunshine. Yes, it's different. So you live in Australia and the Christmas is in the summertime and there is no snow, and you have a nice dinner with lots of laughter. You go to beautiful beaches because it's the summertime. You go for a swim or do fishing, and that's so much different with what's happening in the Northern Hemisphere. And it's a kind of it. Have fun. We wish you all the best. Merry Christmas, Martin Steiner from Australia. And we wish you and all our listeners around the world, especially our Christian friends and listeners, very happy 2022, New Year and Christmas and all the good things in the world, especially health in the time of pandemic. And stay with us, please. And before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, again, on behalf of IRIB English Radio staff, I congratulate our Christian listeners around the world, the birth anniversary of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, and the Christmas occasion. So Merry Christmas to our Christian listeners. We wish you and all people around the world peace, love, joy, health, and good tidings on Christmas and the New Year 2022. Keep in touch with IRIB English Radio and have a good time.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pastoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00982122013720. Once again, our phone number is 00982122013720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pastodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. More extremist calls to kill Muslims in India. This time a video surfaced on social media, even with Hindu religious leaders calling for their people to arm themselves and kill Muslims. Now, of course, there are extremist elements all over the world, but the fact that the ruling leaders, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, remain silent during this racist and extremist call says a lot. Since Modi has taken over the country in 2014 as prime minister, India has turned from an ethnically diverse society to one of less tolerant and increased violence. But why? What's the goal? Stay with us on this Spotlight.
Panic is on the rise among minorities, particularly Muslims in India. While one can be arrested, threatened, or intimidated for even criticizing the majority, threats against the minorities with vicious hate speeches and ferocious social media campaigns hardly face the course of law. In recent weeks, several far-right groups with ties to the ruling party have called for ethnic cleansing of minorities, especially the country's Muslims.
Slowly, they are moving towards their target, that is to make India the fascist country. Unfortunately, the secular parties in India, they are weak, they are not united, they don't pose any challenge to the Hindutva element.
A three-day religious event, which was held in the northern Indian city of Hyderabad from 17 to 19 December, faced a tremendous backlash on social and political domains. The event witnessed a dramatic quantity of hate speeches, mobilization threats, and violence against Muslims. Local media reports say some ruling party members also attended the event. Critics say these groups are operating and functioning with a strong political patronage.
Government is trying an agenda which imposed on the Hindutva. They are trying to turn this country into the Hindutva country. And we will never ever allow this government to turn into the Hindutva. We will fight for this democratic right.
They are picking such issues intentionally during elections, and Muslims have always been soft target. Sometimes it's the eating habits of Muslims, sometimes their religious affairs.
While Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi boasts about democracy in India, critics accuse the ruling party of failing to stop violence against the minorities. Since the emergence of ruling BJP in 2014, anti-Muslim sentiments have been on the rise. A police case has been registered to investigate the matter, but there is no arrest yet. Rights activists say there is a less chance of any action by the administration considering the earlier incidents. They say if not addressed in accordance with the rule of the law, it could tear apart social harmony in a diverse country like India, which has a remarkable history of communal violence. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the spotlight, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto. And the Chairman of Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masood Shajare, out of Peshma.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome both of you to the program. Well, I'd like to start this off with Zafar. Thanks so much again for being with us. Do you think that the ruling party, BJP party, is specifically targeting Muslims? And if so, why would that be the case?
Absolutely. The ruling party's origins, and particularly those of Narendra Modi, are from a group called the RSS, Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. It's a fascist outfit. It has more than 6 million members, and their avowed aim is to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu society in which there is absolutely no room for other religious minorities, be they the 200 million Muslims or millions of Christians or even Dalits that constitute something like 200 million people. The BJP, the ruling party, operates at two levels. Number one, by polarizing the population, it believes that it can garner the support of the Hindu majority, which of course it is doing. But at the same time, it is beholden to these extremist groups that want to turn India into an exclusivist Hindu state in which there is no room for minorities, and that is also being pursued. If we look at the record of Modi since he became the Prime Minister in 2014, we see an alarming rise in anti-Muslim attacks in all parts of India, particularly around Delhi, places like Gurgaon and other places. Muslims are not given permission to build mosques. They are being targeted either because there are cow vigilantes who accuse Muslims of slaughtering cows, which is considered a sacred animal in India, or even accusing Muslim vendors, small vendors, of installing their push carts on roadsides, accusing them of blocking traffic when in fact there are no such allegations or accusations made against Hindus. Mm-hmm. So there are two aspects to this whole campaign. Number one, that Modi and his henchmen have found that polarizing the society garners them support in India because it's a majority Hindu country anyway, and therefore they don't care for the other people. It's not in that sense a true democracy. And number two, there is a very, very strong and dangerous movement in India that wants to turn India into a Hindu state.
Okay.
And that movement is actually supported by the ruling party, and that's the frightening part of it.
All right. Well, Masood, your take. You heard what Zafar said. I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to think of this country with the size of it. And we're talking about Muslim population over 200 million. If that is the case, if actually Modi or BJP, they really want to turn this into a Hindu nation, I mean, what does that mean? How do they think that that can be accomplished just looking at the sheer numbers?
It's very dangerous. I'm afraid this has been going on for quite a long time. It's going back even sort of before the new government being sworn in. I mean, in Gujarat, we had under governorship of Modi sort of ethnic cleansing and clashes and massacres of Muslims, which never dealt with appropriately, neither internationally or nationally within India. And this sort of Hindutva movement, which is pushing the idea of otherization and sort of concentrating on demonizing anyone who is not Hindu, it's getting strength. And unfortunately, I have to say that it's out of control. We are not just it, which has been going on and has been going on for a very long time, but we are actually seeing legislation after legislation discriminating against the Muslims in India on censorship and on even saying that any religious group could actually, from the neighboring country, could go to India and get sanctuary, except Muslims.
Right.
And so this exceptionalization against Muslims is going on, and I think international community, and indeed even the Muslim nations, are completely silent to this demonization. And even there are number of token Muslim leaders who's actually part of BJP and promoting this. And also, just to throw in, the situation of Kashmir, which is part of that sort of demonization of Muslims,
right,
and denying them the right, is again very obvious and very clear. Something needs to be done,
okay,
on a matter of urgency.
Well, what about that, Zafar? Masood said that something needs to be done. I want to look at starting inside of the country itself. I mean, India likes to call itself the largest democracy in the world. How did this legislation, for example, the citizenship law, actually pass? I mean, in a country that says it's democratic and then has this very extremist elements that is growing. Tell me about the inside of the country and how this is allowed to happen.
Well, basically, what the BJP is doing is, as you pointed out, that it is enacting laws through parliament because the BJP has a majority in parliament. And this national citizenship law, which they have passed, which basically disenfranchises Muslims, and they can be essentially thrown out of the country. In fact, these are moves going on right now in India, in certain parts of India that they are enacting. Then there are other aspects. In fact, the Indian constitution, for instance, says that all citizens have equal rights. But as far as the BJP is concerned, it does not believe in this. One of the BJP's leaders, Subramaniam Swamy, was being interviewed by Britain's Channel 4, and she asked him directly and said that your constitution says that all citizens have equal rights, so why are Muslims being persecuted? And Subramaniam Swamy openly said that we do not consider Muslims to be equal to Hindus, and therefore they cannot have equal rights. When you look at this situation, this is absolutely frightening, that they are actually instituting laws to discriminate against Muslims and to consider them as being alien to that country. In fact, these Hindu extremist groups have made absolutely no secret of the fact that the Muslims must either convert to Hinduism or they have to be killed, as this recent meeting of December 17th to 19th that took place in Haridwar in India, and they categorically stated that we need to arm ourselves, that we need to start to kill Muslims, and we need to eliminate these Muslims. And when you look at the fact that Narendra Modi hasn't even uttered a word of condemnation of this, speaks volumes that he is actually encouraging and supporting this kind of attitude and behavior. And I'm afraid if serious action is not taken, first of all by Muslim countries, secondly by the larger international community, I am afraid that there is going to be a genocide of Muslims in India on such a horrendous scale that will boggle the mind. And I'm afraid this is where it is heading unless immediate action is taken.
Well, let's look at the international aspect to this, Masood. Do you see any action coming from the international community or Muslim communities? You talked about earlier that there is not enough being done. What is being done, and what do you think should be done?
Well, really, nothing positive has been done. I mean, we have seen that some of these Persian Gulf countries like Bahrain and others have actually awarded Modi with the highest award and recognition. It's outrageous that this is happening at the time that so openly, so publicly, so institutionally, Muslims are being demonized and to the extent that the slaughtering of them, it is really becoming very obvious that if nothing is happening, then we are going to see ethnic cleansing and genocide against Muslims. And let us remember that this is going long way back. I mean, colonial power, Britain in particular, were involved in this divide and rule policy, which actually has already once resulted in genocide of hundreds and millions of people in India in the partition time. And now this new ideology and Hinduism is an ideology which is fixed on ethnic cleansing, fixed on supremacy, and fixed on promoting this. And it's being promoted systematically. Their supporters, the United States, are becoming powerful and lobby, and so I can't see anything is going to happen automatically. We need to bring awareness, and India is going down a route which I think genocide and ethnic cleansing is just around the corner. Hmm. And I'm not being alarmist. This is actually what is happening. And even the Muslim world and countries are absolutely in daydreaming while this is taking place.
Well, Zafar, we know that India has been getting closer and closer to the Zionist regime, Israel. I mean, when hearing some of the things that you were saying, and also Masood was saying, it was like out of the Israeli playbook, some of the issues that the Muslims are facing now in India. Your assessment of that, do you see any similarities to what is taking place and perhaps Israeli influence in this, or your assessment of that side of things?
Oh, absolutely. The Indian fascists, Hindutva fascists, are actually following the Israeli model completely. What the Zionists are doing to the Palestinian people in Palestine, this is precisely what these Hindutva fascists are doing to Muslims in India, except that the scale is much larger in India, because in India we have at least 200 million Muslims. You know, I would echo exactly what Masood said, that these anti-Muslim pogroms and riots have been going on since day one of the creation of India. But since the BJP came to power, it has escalated alarmingly, because these fascist groups now have a state at their disposal. And let me give you some examples. For instance, the police force in India, in most parts of India, are infested by these Hindutva fascists. So when Muslims are being targeted, even if they go to lodge a complaint, the police don't pay any attention. You look at the latest example that happened on December 17th to 19th, when a complaint was lodged, although evidence was presented to the police that, look at these Hindu fascists that are openly declaring that they should arm themselves and perpetrate a genocide against the Muslims, only one person has been charged out of an entire group of thousands that were involved in that. That gives you an indication of the level of infiltration that has taken place of these fascist elements. The same thing applies to the bureaucracy in India. You go everywhere and you see that today Muslims are, first of all, deprived of their economic rights. Now they're being deprived of their political rights, and they're actually being killed, and very little is being done inside India. So we see that the playbook that the Zionists are following in Palestine, in occupied Palestine, is being repeated in India. I want to add one other point, and that is that India is now considered an ally of the United States and of the West in general, because they want to target China and they want to rope in India on their side. In the United States, there is an organization called the United States Commission for International Religious Freedom. For 2 years in a row, 2020 and 2021, this organization called upon the U.S. State Department to say that India is a country of concern because of religious persecution of minorities, and the State Department should put it on its list. For 2 years in a row, the State Department has categorically refused to do so, claiming and stating that just because India is an ally, that we would not do such a thing. So I'm afraid we are facing a very, very serious situation whereby, regrettably, neither the Muslim countries nor the broader international community is going to do anything about it. And that is why I said that there is a very, very serious risk of a genocide of Muslims taking place in India.
Masood, you had mentioned Kashmir earlier. And again, when I talk about that comparison between what the Israeli regime is doing, and we look at Kashmir, that situation, and how at one point in time they were able to keep their land and just other Muslims from the region could, but now Modi, with the law that was passed, actually allows anyone to go in there, and we see an unbelievable crackdown on Kashmir. My question is, do you think there is going to be blowback for all of this inside of India from what is being done in Kashmir, from what is being done inside of India to the minority communities in general, as Zafar had pointed out? The Muslims are 200 million. There are also Christians and others. Do you think that we're going to see some type of reaction from within India, or does pressure have to come from outside?
I think the pressure has to come from outside and inside combined. The reality is that they have, I mean, as I mentioned, Gujarat massacre was a sort of exercise to see if they could get away with it. It happened at the time that they weren't in absolute power, but nevertheless, with all the evidence which was there, and we presented extensive